You're no woman.
Now, honey.
Not a woman!
Easy.
Gentlemen.
Not a woman!
Meet Lud.
You're listening to Exposition Street, a brand new podcast from your fine feathered nerds over at Prismatic Tsunami. My name is Eric. I'm your host, and we're going to be talking movies, and we'll have like cool, clever taglines for all this as we get a little bit more into it. But this is episode one. Thank you so very much for joining us today. I'm going to introduce our panel. We got Rich here with us today.
Hey, I'm here in the house.
Vanessa.
Hello.
We got Jason.
Hola.
And Kid.
Hello, party people.
Put your hands in the air. How's everybody doing? Good to see everybody. Okay,
doing good.
So we all watched a movie this week, and we thought we'd jabber about it for a little bit. And we started things off with a movie that is very near and dear to my heart, probably a little bit to many of us, I think. Just real quick, nobody had not seen this movie before, right? I mean, that's not a thing.
Looking at you, Vanessa.
I've seen it before.
I saw it when it came out.
I saw it before, but I was very distracted when I was watching it. It was also came out just after I graduated high school, so I was a little interested in other things.
I saw it, right. But only because I enjoyed the comic book.
So we're going to talk about what movie it is. I love this theme. From 1988... May of 1988, actually, it was like right before the Memorial Day release. Willow, starring, we'll get to that. Directed by Ron Howard, written by George Lucas, and Bob Dolman did the screenplay. And it was over 2 hours long, which back then was a lot to sit through.
2 hours and 6 minutes.
Yeah. Actually, it opened like opposite Rambo 3 and Crocodile Dundee 2. So I was really happy to see that it took the top box office that weekend.
I would hope.
Wait, this movie beat Crocodile Dundee 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although back then, I'd have to look at specific dates, but back then they didn't really seem to do a lot of opening a lot of big movies right exactly on the same weekend. So it might not have been opening the same weekend. Those were movies right around that time.
True.
They were what was in the theater right then, but... But Willow definitely had a strong opening weekend. Ironically, was still considered a flop because, you know, fantasy. But I think it'll be a fun movie to talk about. So,
oh, yeah. Fun to talk about.
I'll kind of run through some of the specs here and discuss it. According to, I forgot to put on which website I got this from, but the box office, it did pull in. It was budgeted about $35 million. I have no idea what that would be today. But at the time, obviously, it was a pretty hefty budget. They had a lot of effects and they had a lot of outdoor shoots, obviously, and it was a kind of an expensive movie to make. It grossed $57.2 million in the U.S. The opening weekend was like $8 million, though, which is one of the things that, you know, it was like I said, it was the top at for that weekend, but it wasn't necessarily a huge pull. I think they really needed better out of it in order to make it work. And you'd think anything with George Lucas's name on it. I mean, I realize it was like 5 years after Jedi, right? But
right.
You'd think anything with George Lucas's name should have been prime. I actually remember this as the first movie to have the new Lucasfilm logo at the beginning. You guys know what I'm talking about? The green boxy kind of Lucasfilm logo. Because
yeah.
back before that, they didn't. That was originally the Star Wars. If you watch any of the Star Wars movies now, it has that green, that cool logo.
The branding.
But back then, they was something else. You know, I don't remember what it was. But
inflation calculator says $76 million, by the way.
Oh, that's not bad. That's not bad at all.
Ooh, I was right in the ballpark.
So Willow, starring Val Kilmer, who got top billing despite not being the titular character.
He was in that one scene.
I was gonna say.
There's a couple things I'm going to regret about this particular grouping of panelists, I think. Top Gun came out in 86, so he was just really, I mean, it was a couple years later. He's really off of Top Gun doing the shoots for this. He hadn't done the Jim Morrison thing yet, so he was still really obviously very much at the top of his game. And it's funny, we were talking about movies to do after this. We were talking about trying to come up with movies for our first few episodes or something, and like one of the immediate ones came to mind was another Val Kilmer. I didn't even realize it. I mentioned The Saint. And I'm like, oh, let's do the Kilmer Express for a few episodes or something.
That's does that mean we can do Real Genius?
Heck yeah.
Man, that's a that's a tough one.
Yeah, I know how to get to you people.
That's a tough one.
Little Pickles. Little Pickles.
I was literally just saying earlier.
Look at Vanessa. Never seen it.
I said, I didn't remember a lot of the movie when I went through and watched it again. And if you told me a week ago that there was a movie in the late 80s where Val Kilmer was running around in a dress looking studly, I'd been like, no, I never saw a movie like that. Apparently I did. I just forgot.
That's like the scene that I used for the opening right there. It was the very first clip I thought of when I thought I want to do a clip right at the beginning. What do I want it
it's
to be?
It's a really good one.
By the way, one of the creepiest lines in movie history that I've watched in recent memory. Wanna breed?
It was the 80s.
With his wife in the room.
And a baby in between them.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So Val Kilmer, who obviously was very good in this role. This was, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I'll get a whole lot of blowback from you guys. So that the audience doesn't yet realize, I'm going to mostly say complimentary things about like everything ever made. And these guys are going to do what they can to lower my expectations. I think that's the way
it down
this,
a bit.
We actually refer to that as Ericking.
Yeah.
It takes the four of us to counterbalance.
Joanne Whaley, Wally Whaley, got second building. God, I can't talk. Joanne was actually, she wasn't known for a lot. So I don't know why she got second billing over Warwick Davis. Taller, maybe? I'm really confused about this.
And since this is our first episode, I'm going to go ahead and out myself on this right here and right now. 99% of the actors and actresses you guys mentioned by name, I will have no idea who you're talking about. There's like 20 actors out there.
You just watched the movie.
Yes, I know. There's like 20 actors out there that I actually know by name. I know characters. I don't know actors. Okay. I don't see.
You know Val Kilmer.
I don't see actors. So I know Val Kilmer. He's the one person in this movie that I knew by name going
in. And Mardigan.
That's for future reference, by the way. When you guys start talking about actors and actresses, odds are I'll be sitting here going, yeah, that's what I do, by the way. You guys might not realize it. When people talk to me about actors and actresses, I'm just like, yeah, I remember that. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So if we see the nod and smile, we know that we're really going over your head.
Right.
Gotcha.
That's how you talk to me all the time. Now I'm confused.
Yeah, you're one of the people who does that to me.
Have we ever had a conversation?
Yeah.
You mean where I actually knew what you were saying? Yeah. No,
it's pretty good. I told him we were doing this show, and he said, who's this rich person on your list? I don't understand.
Yeah, rich, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He only knows you by the characters you play, man.
That's true. Oh. I know your characters very well.
That's
Vordar. Okay, never mind.
Right? No, that's how it works. If you say an actor and I'm like, and then you say the character, I'm like, oh yeah.
He's Vordar.
Yeah, I've seen him in other movies.
Rich. Oh yeah, I know Rich.
So I looked it up. Joanne Whaley, actually, by the way, she and Kilmer got married after this. They met on the set and were together for a while.
The Hollywood thing.
Yeah.
It was that kiss, wasn't it?
Man, that love potion was stronger than we thought it was.
Now, if that was true, the guy that played the brownie would have married the cat.
He did.
Who said he did?
You don't know.
Wait a minute. Wasn't that Kevin Pollak?
Yes, it was.
I did look her up. She was in like The Man Who Knew Too Little, which wasn't like almost 10 years later. Bill Murray thing.
Oh, I remember that.
That's about the only other recognizable thing she had a credit for.
That's a little on the nose, isn't it?
And Warwick Davis had third billing. And Warwick Davis revealed that, I mean, in several interviews, he's mentioned that George made the movie for him. you know, he was talking to him about it clear back. Sometimes you'll see people say clear back during Jedi, but what it was is when he was in 83 when he was working on the Ewok adventure movie.
Wasn't he like 12 at that point?
Yeah, he was a kid. I mean, in fact, that was what took them a little bit longer to make Willow, was that he wanted to let him mature a little bit.
And by the time they did Willow, he'd grown up and had two kids of his own.
I don't think that's the way that worked.
No, I saw them.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the movie.
I caught a little bit of their acting, too, just so we could share in that.
Those kids were so cute.
So, Willow, what are our thoughts? Anyone want to start? Don't all talk at once, man.
That's a very broad statement. Are you looking for something specific?
Well, what jumped out at you? Well, you guys all watched the movie this week.
Siskel and Ebert.
Not what?
You asked what jumped out at me.
Well,
okay. Not in an alley. I mean, what did you say in the movie?
I meant in the movie. The two-headed dragon, Siskel and Ebert.
Siskel and Ebert, the two-headed dragon.
I forgot about that one.
Oh, yeah. Now, in a more serious thing, the thing that really got to me with the whole... I keep saying hobbits, because in my mind, they were always hobbits, and I learned today they're actually
Nelwyn.
Yeah, they're Nelwyn.
Nelwyn.
Right, they're Nelwyn.
You can call them
which
pets. We're okay with that.
No, I like to be friends with the wee people. Which is why I shouldn't call them wee people.
I think this movie, anyways. I read somewhere that it had like the highest number of like actors with dwarfism ever, you know, pulled for a casting call or something.
Well, outside of entire,
do you remember what the Nelwyn village looked like?
Yeah. No, they were all there. I mean, it had to be all of them.
But the village, yeah. But even beyond just that part with the actors being in there, the whole set, this is in a time before massive CGI.
Right.
And... you know, a lot was done to make the whole thing look...
Well, 88, I mean...
really wholesome.
Was there really much in the way of CGI at that point? And was there anything that we were doing in movies that was digitally produced?
There was still some blue screen work and stuff like that.
But I know that the...
coming out of Star Wars is going to be there.
I know that the magic effects in this were all hand-drawn.
Mm-hmm. I was reading about that. Yeah, a lot of it's more practical stuff, and it was really kind of cool. You look at that, and then you look at some modern backgrounds in science fiction and fantasy and go... huh. Yeah, they did it right back then.
it depends on what you're talking about doing it right. The backgrounds for the brownies were almost painful.
Yeah.
That's true.
The effects for the dragon and the brownies are, in my opinion, they're really the only effects in the movie that don't hold up.
At all.
Size dilation, when you had big and small against each other.
And you feel like that
did not hold up.
They were trying probably to say something with that that issue where it was fuzzy in the back, but it was too stark. It was way too, and that's just an opinion, obviously, I don't know. But it like when they had the dragon in the background, making it look kind of like blurry and less clear was probably a way of hoping that it looked realistic because the focus was on the foreground. But it really just looked like bad green screening. That's all it looked like. And that wasn't because there wasn't a real dragon for him to stand in front. I mean, they didn't have any real dragons that I know of at that time.
Another one of the great single moments of the movie, Val Kilmer turning around and seeing the dragon.
The face.
The look on his face. Yeah.
And then running out with the other army before realizing that he went the wrong direction.
Turn around and realize you're surrounded by the other people.
He's very expressive. You got to hand him that.
By the way, I probably should have brought this up before now, but should we have a spoiler alert at the beginning of these podcasts? Just
it came out in 88.
I know that
spoilers are involved.
I know that there are people who weren't born yet, and therefore
you don't get spoiler alerts if you're watching a thing about a movie that's been out for 32
years.
Oh God,
32 years, dude.
Yeah,
but feel old.
Kids can have their kids watching this movie now.
But we're not going to consistently do movies that are as old as we are. There will be newer movies that we will cover on this channel
that are new enough that it's a problem. Yeah,
we can make mention of it. But the truth is, it's going to be in the title. This is an episode about this movie. Don't be an idiot.
we're doing expositions. We're not doing we're not doing trailers.
Right.
Although trailers give away the plots anyway, so I don't know what the deal is with that either.
Good point. This isn't a review. Reviews are respectful and simple.
Yes, but
and professional.
But even EWW has a spoiler tag at the beginning of all his videos. I'm just saying, I think that's like an industry standard.
Whatever.
So there'll be a spoiler tag at the beginning of the video, but yeah. Wow.
Okay, maybe I'll think about that. In future episodes, we'll come up with, if you want to put together a spoiler audio tag for me, something we can put at the beginning of the episode.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like I mentioned an entire army turning into pigs or anything like that.
Oh, see?
Pigs!
I did now.
Pigs!
We have to be able to talk about the movie, guys. Spoilers are not an issue. This is a non-issue. Spoilers are
not an issue. This is a non-issue.
Yeah. I don't get this 2 minutes of my life back now. Thank you.
If you're watching this to decide to watch a movie you haven't seen.
If you're watching this, that's impressive. We're not planning on putting the video up.
I stare at audio files all the time.
But we have the option. We do have the option.
Here I was. Yeah. I changed where my camera was so my shirt would be visible because I thought this was going to be a video cast.
It can be comfortable. We could talk about that. We can't. Jason suddenly starts taking his clothes off.
Oh, no.
Ooh la la.
I'm not taking my clothes off. I'm just getting where you can't see the cool thing on my shirt.
Oop. There were elements of the magic in this movie that did get on my nerves, though, realistically. Like, some things you need spells for. Some things you don't need spells for. Some things you're waving around a wand and it doesn't really matter.
Like Willow's disappearing pig trick.
That is a thing when it comes to magic systems in movies. You always have to make those choices about what the rules are and when you can break the rules. And I think part of it comes down to where the particular people's skills were. Like someone who hasn't worked with magic enough has to do more specific things to get the magic to work, whereas someone who's done it for decades can do things without even thinking about it.
Well, can you think of any examples, though, of movies that, I mean, really showed you magic that wasn't kind of fuzzy? I mean, there's not a lot of time in a movie to really showcase.
No, you're not giving the full extent of what the rules are, but in the background, there are usually a set of rules.
I guess there's a difference between magic that is used purely as a method of conveying the plot, you know, moving things forward or making something happen, and magic that actually has some consistency in terms of how we see it in play. I mean, obviously, the arguments about the Force have been around since, you know, Star Wars premiered. And, well, we have the internet.
It is a magic system. You know.
And it keeps changing, too.
But that's important, I think. I mean, it's fuzzy enough that what we've seen is examples of its use. Mm-hmm. And then even if you stick just to the, especially if you stick just to the movie universe is what we have examples of, in case you haven't seen the Star Wars movies, there's room to expand. I mean, there should be room to expand. And I thought people losing their minds in more recent movies when we saw characters using the Force in ways we hadn't seen before was a little weird, you know? But people really were. You can't do that with the Force. I'm like, why?
Who made you in charge of the canon and why are you here?
It's called power creep. It's a thing.
I can kind of understand where people lost their minds on the Star Trek when they used the transporter beam to go across galaxies.
Transwarp.
but the Force, no. You don't get to complain about that.
I don't really feel like that's much of an issue with most movies because consistency. I mean, like I said, unless it's just blaringly, there's no point. I'm trying to think of any good examples.
I actually thought when I was watching Willow with this, I thought the same thing you did, but I put it in a different thing. I thought they were different types of magic. This is a witch. This is a warlock. This is a wizard. They're drawing their magic from different sources.
Different sources.
They're using it different ways. Some require focus. Some require words. Some require gestures. It's just a matter of
who your magic is. I could go with that if they identified as different things, though. But in the movie, they all identify as sorcerer.
It was already 2 hours and 6 minutes long.
That hit the cutting room floor.
Actually, there was one scene that was cut out I found very amusing. The kid that turned into a fish. I don't know if you guys found that.
I didn't look at any deleted scenes.
Yeah, there was a deleted scene that I don't know why it was removed, but the commenter I was watching suggested that it probably just didn't fit in very well, where there was a bald kid who turned into a giant fish and tried to swallow Willow and the baby on the sea.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah.
That's weird. Okay.
So the scene was like a fish out of water.
It was the only monster that would have been in the movie that wasn't intended to be a snark at a movie critic. All the other monsters in one way or another were snarks at movie critics. So that's why it was noteworthy.
Nice. Yeah, Lucas had an issue with critics in reviewers. Go figure.
No, why?
I really don't feel like there is a problem per se in how it was presented or how it was used. I think the big question, obviously, with power, supernatural things in a movie, in a fantasy particularly, is whether or not they're moving the story forward, whether serving a point, or whether or not they're illustrating the part of the world building that really matters. Now, I don't think that they would have been part of the world building in this in a way that would have been significant, because obviously it wasn't common. You know, the magical mm-hmm. people were pretty extraordinary people, obviously. You know, Ra's'el, Bav Morda, people feared that shit. The High Alden, excuse my language. I'm so used to having podcasts where I can say whatever I want. Go listen to those. But yeah, the whole thing with Willow, I thought it really wasn't so much of an issue. But just my opinion, obviously.
And the only other part with magic that bothered me is that he seems to like organically know spells, except for the one to transform Ra's'Zelda. He learned that one from Ra's'Zelda, but everything else he just kind of makes up on the fly, swings a wand, and all of a sudden something happens.
Yeah, that was a little, I mean, there was
with varying results.
There was a couple points. The chant, of course, that she said use mm-hmm. the such and such chant when she was trying to use the shelter chant or whatever that she's trying to protect from the transformation.
It implied that during the travel,
yeah,
she was talking to him and teaching him and aiding him, and we just didn't see that because she said,
okay, maybe like, I just didn't catch up on
like
that.
When she first wanted him to try to change her, she's like, use the transformation chant I taught you.
Yeah, but that's the only one she explicitly right. says she taught.
So when the next one was, it's like, okay, use the shelter chant in parentheses off script I taught you. Here's something that I have a problem with the movie. The prophecy was bogus.
Prophecy. Yes. That was a weird and unnecessary hook, I think.
The prophecy yeah. said that the baby would destroy her. The baby didn't destroy her.
I thought it was would bring about the end of Queen Bav Morda.
Well,
yeah, bring about
okay.
would imply the third people person kept connection saying, through Willow.
People kept saying, like Shalendria said, you know, if Lord Anna doesn't make it and he has to destroy Bav Morda. But the prophecy at the opening of the movie, I seem to remember them saying, would bring about the end of Queen Bav Morda.
Okay, I guess if it's bring about that makes a little more sense, but it was just like, wait, the baby didn't do nothing.
It was the lack of a baby that brought about the end.
Gets turned into weird things that actually aren't what was said. Yes.
Okay.
Now I did have one of the little things that got to me, and maybe it was just because Lucas's name was on it, but there's a scene where they're doing a cart chase and they're in a cart and their cart's traveling down and they're being chased by other people on horses. And I'm like, okay, this is a whole replay of the speeder bike race in Return of the Jedi, and I'm like, you're just trying to catch lightning in a bottle here and you're driving me crazy and stop it. Although I will say in that there was in fact the Wilhelm scream.
Oh shit, I was supposed to grab that. I forgot. Yes.
Ah, dang dude. It. So the Wilhelm scream.
Well, we'll hear it in another episode. I guarantee it.
I guarantee you we will too. And actually, as I was watching, I found two more instances during the fight at the end where they repeated the Wilhelm scream.
That's funny.
Again. So I counted three. I wish he had that recorded.
Let me see if
I can. You hear it everywhere.
Talk amongst yourselves. I'm going to see if I can find it real fast.
Talk about it yourselves.
Okay.
But yeah, at 53 minutes and 27 seconds in the movie, you get the Wilhelm scream. Well,
that
off
will
of
help
the,
me find it.
Speeder race.
Okay. Anybody want to talk
specific.
About
53:27?
The biblical implications at the beginning?
Go on.
Oh, yes, the Moses connection.
And Jesus. Both of them.
The whole thing.
Oh, the baby in the basket. I thought about that.
A baby is going to be a problem, so I'm going to round up all the babies, kill them so that they're not a problem, and then one baby gets saved down a river.
In a raft, floating free, saved at the other corner of the river by dwarves. Wait, that's not right.
Dwarves, Egyptians.
Pugs. Well, it wasn't. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. In the Bible, yeah. It was Egyptians both times.
And this was streaming on Disney that's Plus. Right. So, see if I've got.
I actually felt like that entire beginning sequence was kind of the evidence that there was some substance to this magical prophecy, because from the moment the baby was smuggled out literally right under the queen's nose to the implication that days, weeks, or even months pass, considering how much hair has grown on her head by then, before the dogs finally catch up with the old lady at the bank of the river, where she drops the baby on a clump of logs and sends it drifting down the road, where it happens to tuck in right in front of two Nelwyn children.
Prophecy. I'm telling you.
Without some agency of prophecy guiding these things, it's way, way too much to believe that it could have actually happened that way.
And they sometimes the DM just has to push the rails.
And they call them dogs, but those things weren't dogs.
Death dogs.
Oh, that's another thing that bothered me. If you're going to have some fantasy creature chasing after them that is going to have the same name as something that already exists, just use the thing that already exists or call it something else.
Yeah, why did they call it dog?
They wanted to be scary.
I think they dressed up Rottweilers for that. So they actually were.
Yes.
They actually were dogs, technically. But they looked like weird boar type creature.
They had that boar porcupine.
Here's the funny thing. I've seen this movie so many times over the years, I could have told you, I could have quoted almost every part of the movie. But I think when it comes to weird kind of details, because of all the BS I have absorbed in the fantasy fiction over the years, I do get weird little details mixed up. And this was one of them. I told when I first watched the movie, because we were talking about movies when we came with the podcast, and it just so happens I'd watched this movie a few weeks prior with my son, who had never seen it. And we were sitting down to watch the movie, and I told him, oh, wait till you see the death dogs. They're two-headed dogs.
No, nope. The dragon.
Because, yeah, right? Anybody know why I thought that, by the way?
No.
Two-headed death dogs?
Yeah. It's actually a creature in D&D. The death dog, if you find the entry, is a two-headed dog.
Right.
So now there you go. I got that queued up if you guys want to hear it.
Oh, you found the Wilhelm scream.
I found the time code you were talking about.
Stamp, yeah.
The 5327, it's in the middle of the cart race.
Okay, well, yeah, this is definitely in the middle of the cart race. I'm going to back it up just a couple seconds, and you'll let me know if you hear it. Was that it?
Barely audible in the back.
Yeah. When he's falling out of the cart.
It's a very cliche.
It's a sound effect that's been in the public domain for a thousand years. So it's just used by every.
If you don't know Wilhelm scream, look it up. There's a billion YouTube videos of just that scream.
There's a 10 hour long Wilhelm scream compilation on YouTube. You can listen to nothing but Wilhelm scream for 10 hours.
Yes, there is.
That's kind of awful. That's really kind of scary.
That's almost as good as the Samuel Jackson every MF compilation.
Oh, my favorite is actually the Shia LaBeouf no compilation. That thing's hilarious. It's like 20 minutes long.
So, you know, they intended this to be a first in a trilogy, which is very Lucas. Yeah.
And again, because it quote unquote failed.
Yeah. Box office results were
stop that
floppy.
Yeah, what does it really require for a fantasy movie in the 80s, you know? And I mean, there were other, that was part of the problem. I mean, he had trouble getting funding apparently because like Labyrinth, Legend, Kroll, Dragon Slayer, they were all released to pretty middling results at the box office. So there was a lot, the studios just weren't interested in going out on a limb for a fantasy flick.
Interestingly enough, the next fantasy movie with small people filmed in New Zealand would proceed to launch a trilogy.
Who saw a trilogy coming out of that? I mean, really?
Right?
I know. It's like there's some sort of weird fellowship happening there.
And if they'd been really clever, they would have filmed all three movies at once. So they definitely had them in the can.
Right. Like they did with the second two Matrix that I pretended never happened.
What are you talking about? I'm sorry.
I don't think that happened.
But I did want to point out one of the interesting things on this. I was reminded while watching through this. I've often said in my gaming podcast, the two ways I like my world, I either like a silly world with straight acting characters or a very straight laced world with silly characters. Willow is a very straight, by the book, this is the world, everything's normal in this world, with a whole bunch of characters that are in themselves silly. And so it fits right in that thing where I like it one way or the other.
Interesting.
So it wasn't a full-blown, this is a hilarious comedy, but there was so much comedy in the characters.
Yeah, there was a lot of great
Matt Mardigan did a lot of silly things, dressing, doing the stuff in the dress, running around without his shirt on. Okay, maybe that wasn't comedy.
And then there were brownies.
And then the brownies.
We should probably talk about the brownies. So the casting was really interesting. Kevin Pollak, I mean, he was already practically a legend at that point.
Right.
I read somewhere that during during the shoot, when they were in the city, you know, when they were shooting on sets and stuff, they'd roll down to the pub there in LA, I think it was. They'd roll down to a stage where they could do some just improv. And I don't know if it was Kevin and I lost his name now, the guy that played Franchine. Can somebody look that up?
Rick Overton. Just thinking, yes.
Overton, yeah. I don't know if it was them two, but I kind of got the impression it was like maybe they were just, it was a way of just enhancing their chops, you know, their relationship between their characters and all that, having fun with it. And then like one of the audience members kept getting up there and doing like little bits with them. And he was so good that Kevin Pollak kind of stood back and let him have, and that was Robin Williams. So I think that's great.
That sounds right.
But I really think the brownies added a lot more to the movie than I gave them credit for.
Right.
You know, when you start thinking about the kind of the role they played, I mean, not only in getting kind of propelling the story forward by capturing the baby at the beginning, towards the beginning. And,
right.
You know, and
right, because you know. It survived the plot line. It saved the plot line.
Right. Right about the time dying. You're thinking, how the heck does Willow even stay in this movie after this point?
Right. And then they come through.
Of course, they're the comic relief all the way through it. They're the comic relief.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And a lot of it visual.
They build up even farther on that.
Brownies, little French people dressed like Ewoks.
I was kind of sad that I didn't get a lot of clips, or I didn't really have a lot of good clips because they didn't. Most of the gags really weren't audio. I mean, sometimes they'd be a line.
There's
in there.
A lot of sight gags. But it was really great. It's visually great to watch. Yeah. I mean,
which was a very pretty movie too. That's
something you should find time to sit there and
also really dug the villain. I thought Bab Morda was awesome.
Oh, yes,
she was good.
Yes.
She was one of the most believable fantasy villains I remember seeing in...
Right.
And unequivocally evil. I mean, there were just no redeeming qualities about her.
She was evil, but she was truly motivated. She had what she wanted. She wanted to maintain her power, and she knew something was going to destroy it, and she wasn't going to let it. She was motivated by her own things, but we weren't forced to empathize with that. She was allowed to be evil, even though she had great motives, which I love that. I love the fact that she was a real person with real motives.
And I always remember General Kale as being a particularly imposing figure, but he didn't really do much. I mean,
yeah.
Realistically, Bab Morda didn't either. I mean, she has like 15 minutes of screen time.
Oh, yeah. No, she just needed to do a bunch of snarling and ejecting words that were kind of mean, you know.
Although a lot of the things
easily see.
Bab Morda did, she didn't do on screen.
Right.
That's true.
When they got to the Happy Castle and there were all of these people encased in glass tombs. Whoa.
So Willow was the hero of the story. So we have that kind of everyman kind of character, right? I mean, he's just and a little dude. So the illusion that he was a small person growing into a bigger world was, I mean, literally in front of you the whole time, right?
He was even little by Nelwyn standards.
Yeah, yeah. He was short for Nelwyn.
Right. And he was definitely a zero level character. I mean, he didn't even have his beginning character class.
And that's a trope, right? I mean, that hero's journey kind of thing in there that mm-hmm. happens mm-hmm. with that. And we had like the wise word person guide with Roselle.
Billy Barty.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we should talk about that.
Billy Barty is awesome, period. And he played High Alduin.
We're gonna have a movie with a whole bunch of little people in it. Who's the most famous little person we know? Anybody? Anybody?
Right.
In 1988?
Right. He is so awesome.
Because Peter Dinklage wasn't around yet, you know?
Right.
Right.
I have to admit, during the crowd scenes, I was looking for him. I'm like, okay, is he in there somewhere in the background?
He was like, maybe like, he was like four, man. Movie he was like four.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he was one of the kids. Billy Barty had my favorite line in the whole movie. I will consult the bones. Rattle, rattle, rattle. Toss. The bones tell me nothing.
Tell me nothing.
Yes.
That eyebrow. Oh my God.
The eyebrow. I know. Follow the bird. The bird's going back to the village.
Ignore the bird.
No, ignore the bird.
Go to the river.
Ignore the bird. which tells you everything you need to know about magic.
And then, you know, and we're on the Lucas train here, right? So we have our everyman hero, and we have our wise guides, and we have our Han Solo character.
We have our rogue, have
Mad,
our
Mad
roguish,
Mardigan.
Our roguish hero.
And Mad Mardigan is probably, I mean, one of my favorite heroes at the time in that style, because I really, really love fantasy. I mean, Star Wars was the thing that grabbed my imagination the most as a kid, but Star Wars was basically fantasy in space. So, I mean, I really always kind of clove to that anyway, and Willow was one of the first really good fantasy movies, live-action fantasy movies that captured all the things that I really wanted in that kind of film. And Mad Mardigan was an amazing example of what a warrior on screen should look like and act like and feel like. And I think that because of that, there's been a lot that I've styled in my way of as a writer, as a game master, you know, doing all the stuff with D&D over the years. I really kind of styled a lot of my expectations about that archetype around his performance. And I mean, he was, like you said, he was a little goofy. He was exaggerated. He was horribly exaggerated. You know, it just so happens that Val Kilmer. Did you know that John Cusack was up for this role? Apparently,
I had meant to mention that.
I can see it.
I
can see it.
I don't know about that.
No,
Mad Mardigan.
No,
Val Kilmer has a better. I mean, Val Kilmer has an incredible range. But anyways, that's
John Cusack.
He could do things. You just
I'm not sure
seen
what
him
he looks. I'm not sure what he looks like in the 80s, but 2020 John Cusack would not look good.
The shirtless scenes would have lacked a certain something.
The rest of us know what
Josh
he looked like
Brolin,
in the 80s.
If you're going to pick somebody from those movies, Josh Brolin maybe, but John Cusack?
Joshua was always a little brutish looking when he was young, though. Goonies Josh? Was like, I don't know. He looked kind of long
wait,
face.
Wait,
and kind of,
are you telling me Thanos was in the Goonies?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, I got to go back and watch that again.
Watch Deadpool 2. There's a couple jokes about it.
Of course there is.
There's
Ryan Reynolds makes a couple of Goonies cracks at Cable.
Of course he does.
And a Thanos right joke at Cable, too.
Yeah, I caught that one.
You guys want to hear clips?
Sure.
Clips?
Give us clips.
And I mean, you know, this is a loose show, so if you guys have other stuff you want to... You know, discuss. I did capture a little bit of the dog sound. I thought that was really. I was trying to decide if they did any kind of digital manipulation of any kind.
That was one of the little nitpicky things I meant to bring up. It bothered me rewatching this for the whatevereth time that I had never caught this in a previous viewing. But when Babmorta sends out the dogs after the wet nurse, she specifically says, "Send out the dogs. Bring her back alive." When the dogs finally get there are no handlers to be seen anywhere, and the dogs just proceed to eat the wet nurse, and presumably if she had still had the baby, they would have eaten the baby too, considering the way they tried to eat everything else that vaguely resembled or smelled
dogs
like a baby.
Dogs can't follow certain commands.
Okay, point of order. I will make one comment to that. First, I think the her
was
is the baby.
Laura Dannon, yeah.
And secondly, I think the dogs were super crazy trained, because after the Nelwyn killed the dogs, they held up a little baby carrier that was strapped to one of the dogs and said they were looking for a baby.
Oh, I thought that that was something in the Nelwyn village that they had attacked. I didn't realize that was on one of the dogs.
I
hadn't caught that either.
That was my interpretation of it. You know, it's like they killed the dog, and then they held up a little crib thing and said they were looking for someone's baby.
I caught dog sound effects.
Well, you have to hand it to those things; they really sound like dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm scared. Hold me.
And a little closer on one on that really kind of rough kind of.
Sound vicious.
Yeah, that's freaking scary stuff, right?
I want to play
with that. Yeah, that's terrifying. Okay. I would hate to meet one of those in a dark alley.
I made a comment that I'd watched Willow when it first came out. The reason why I had only watched Willow when it first came out is because it freaked me the F out. And I never watched it again.
Oh, so sad.
It was so creepy.
You're also kind of young, brother.
That's not true. You just watched it again.
Yeah, I like I said, my son recently watched it for the first time. He's 11. He dealt with it pretty well. But, of course, kids today are exposed to a little more, too, than we were when we were kids.
Just a little.
Child acting for you.
But Dad, it's a baby.
Oh my God, those kids
are not like us.
No, it's not an Alvin. Looks like a Daikini baby.
What's a Daikini?
Daikinis are big. Giants who live far away.
I loved the terminology.
Was I the only one that...
I did.
The only one who, when they first said Daikini, heard, Daikini!
Yes.
Yes, yes, it was just you. Yes,
that was literally the first thing I heard in my head. Daikini!
Why am I not surprised? Yeah, the whole thing with the kids, and I mean they did I think okay for their age. I mean, they're fine, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it was well
so directed. Cute.
That was their role, adorable. Right? Was to be cute.
And they did well on portraying Willow as the father figure.
Did anybody look and see if those kids went on to do any other acting? I have
nothing.
No idea.
Absolutely nothing. They each had one credit.
Oh.
Really?
They're probably somebody's kids. Obviously.
I mean, hope.
I meant somebody notable, but I was going to say, obviously, though, if they were, you know, little people, then there would have been, there are a lot of those people there in the casting call to kind of bring kids down and try out for roles. So I imagine they had their pick just a little bit.
The term is Nelwyn.
Yeah, the term is Nelwyn.
Nelwyn, yeah.
Right. And we are Daikini, giants who live in the north. I just labeled this one transition.
Bye.
Oh, I just like the transition from the baby to the chicken or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so smooth. I was like, huh, did they do that intentionally?
Did someone turn Laura Dannon into a chicken?
Yes.
Wow, I missed that.
It had to happen.
That was an act.
I mean, it was probably Willow with that stupid wand.
That was an act one, though.
You're losing.
You need
me.
To concentrate.
You're losing me.
That was an act one. Willow. And to be fair, act one went for a while. I mean, I got to do this. I got to do it. I like music. I just had to catch some of the festival music.
Oh, I love those instruments.
Yeah! And again, their vision of what a festival would be like in a village like that. It's just right in line, you know?
Oh, yeah. It very real.
Oh, yeah.
You know the trope of the whole coincidence that something happens and, oh, hey, the next day just happens to be the festival.
Right. That, like you do.
Yeah. Like you do.
Well, you got to show life in the village. I mean, you got to make it fun, right? And then, you know.
Honestly, it's almost to the point where any time a festival or some other kind of special gathering appears in a movie, you know it's because something related to the plot has to happen.
Okay, speaking of
there's
relating
there's never to a the festival plot. Just for the sake of it being a festival.
Speaking of relating to the plot, why do we have the evil threat about, I will take your land? No difference. That had no impact on anything.
I can't decide whether...
Burgle Cut was...
The guy's a jerk, you know.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah,
just,
I think that was the entire point of that. Is Burgle Cut was a jerk.
It was just to establish that you didn't like the guy. That was the whole 100%.
That's a good question. Does that kind of character really advance anything in the plot? I mean, was he just there to contrast Willow to give us somebody for him to conflict with early on?
I think it's meant to make you more sympathetic to the main character, whom you're just meeting,
by showing
that
he's
that he doesn't have an easy life.
That's part of establishing the beginning of the hero's journey, the reluctant hero.
Oh, well, this is Lucas. Usually it's the whiny hero. And so
it's a different form, confused. But the same thing, right?
Plus, it was great when the wizard's like, and you go with him.
I don't know if I caught that. I don't think I did. But.
Well, because the main fighter guy wants to go with Willow, and Burgle Cut says, no, he's the best fighter in the village. You can't leave.
He needs to stay
And then Billy Barty goes, the bones tell me I need a leader. Burgle Cot, you will be the leader. Hero!
And that was well done, too, because they showed you the look on the Elwyn's face when he's like, no, he needs to stay here and guard the village. He's looking at him like, oh, really? Okay, let's see you change your tune.
So, speaking of Mr. Barty.
Magic is the bloodstream of the universe. Forget all you know.
What?
Or think you know.
The eyebrows.
All that you require is your intuition.
I love it. He was so good in that part. You know,
yes.
It could not have been anybody to get that kind of effect, I think.
No, it couldn't have been anybody.
The facial expressions were so good.
So great.
He's awesome. Of course, the other thing about him sending Burglecott on the mission was the fact that he'd already said, the bones tell me nothing. So then he goes, the bones say the leader is Burglecott.
He was literally
pulling on purpose.
That was... Now, okay, here's another problem I have with that. The group that accompanied Willow?
Yeah.
Pointless.
Yeah, played no role whatsoever.
The only thing they did while they accompanied Willow was hide in the bushes when the soldiers go by.
I've got that. Do you guys want to hear that?
And then throw a fit when he doesn't want to give the baby to the guy in the cage. And then they leave.
But one of them was Tony Cox. So Tony Cox was cool.
Is that Migosh?
No, he was one of the actual warriors that was added.
Oh, who's that?
Yeah, Migosh was David Steinberg. Tony Cox is an actor I'd like to... He did a number of things back in the day.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Maybe it's just me. Yeah, thanks, kid. Thanks, kid.
All right. Yeah,
heard.
No, I was wondering about this, because the scene with the soldiers in the woods, I don't have to play it. I just captured it to remind myself. That is literally just exposition. Right? I mean, it really is. How ridiculous is this? Something is just weird. We see this in a lot of movies. You have it where the hero has a chance to overhear the bad guys talking about something that gives them key information about the plot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're right there. You know, I mean, how often that's the kind of shit that happens all the time. I mean,
And why did they hide in the first place? They were supposed to go out, find a Dakini, give the baby to the first Dakini they see, and come.
There they were.
Here comes a whole bunch of Dakini on horses. Hide!
Dakini with dogs that had attacked the village.
Right.
So good call.
They were probably the ones attacking the village.
Good call.
Oh, nice save,
so you want
Nessa.
To pick a good Dakini. And I also, part of that whole thing was so that Willow could have that crisis of trusting Mad Mardigan or not. But then at the the voice of, yeah, let's go ahead and just do this, came from the Burglecott, rather than Willow having to do a monologue, which would have been less exciting.
Speckin' of whom?
Give me some water, Peck, or you die. You understand? Water.
Am I the only one that thinks that Peck was like a super crazy racial slur and this movie
was
horrible?
That was intended to be.
Because everybody, everywhere, Peck.
Out of the way, Peck!
Overused
racial slur.
That could have just been Mad Mardigan's little rant.
No, it wasn't just Mad Mardigan.
No, everybody else used
everybody.
It as well.
The queen, the witch, the brownies.
Everybody
the people
in the
bar. Peck. And if it was meant to be a racial slur, by the 30th time I heard it, it was getting really uncomfortable, and I kept waiting for Willow to just go.
So what is that? I mean, what role does that play? It illustrates that there's a general sort of bias that they're looked down on for some reason by the rest of society.
I felt like the word was carefully chosen specifically to convey this dismissive, contemptuous, and that's the way all of the big people look down upon the little people.
I have more Mad Mardigan. You guys want to hear more Mad Mardigan?
Sure.
Of course.
Yeah.
Doesn't everyone?
Come on, let me out of here, Eric. Give me a sword. I'll win this war for you.
Mad Mardigan, I still serve Galadorn. You serve no one. Remember? Sit in your coffin and rot.
I love this part.
Chow!
Wait, Eric.
You need me.
I'll be around long after you're dead. When I get out of here, I'm gonna cut your head off and stick it on a pig pole!
Which assuming is the kind of pole you put over a fire, a spit.
Right.
Now, I will say, he was half right. He is alone long after he's dead, but when he was dead, they reconciled.
Spoilers.
Conveniently.
What point did Eric actually serve in the movie, though? He was like a weird subline that didn't really do anything.
Their Congo relationship drove me crazy.
Ex Machina.
It's Ex Machina.
He was Ex Machina.
Exposition.
And exposition.
But he wasn't, I guess in terms of the fact that he brought people with him in most every scene.
Every time he showed up, it's like, Eric's army is coming. They wouldn't have been able to, even though they home aloned the shit out of that castle, they wouldn't have lived if Eric's army hadn't shown up at just the right time. Even though they slid down a mountain through perilous little passages and went through perfect little slots and ramps and stuff and just perfect all the way down to get ahead of the bad guys, they wouldn't have survived that hut if Eric and his team hadn't been there with a hole in the floor of the room.
As a quick aside, I just wanted, since you mentioned that, I really felt like that should have been a ride at a theme park.
Yeah.
I would have loved that. Continue.
Horrible little continuity error thing.
Yeah.
Going through the snow on the sled. Billows of snow coating the people on the sled. Cut to the people. Not even a drop of water. Then they cold back away. They hit another burp. White. They're snowmen. Cut back. Not even a flake of snow on the baby's hair.
The stakes are important.
Elora Dallin must survive. She must fulfill her destiny.
Kind of likes that effect with her.
Queen Batwater, whose powers are growing like an evil plague. Unless she is stopped, Batwater will control the lives of your village, your children, everyone.
The stakes, right? I mean, that's our prophecy major
impetus. Is the stakes.
And once again, we have the bullshit. Oh, sorry, the bull cocky nature of the prophecy brought up there, because, you know, Elora Dannon must fulfill her destiny. Well, apparently, that destiny doesn't really require her to do anything.
Her destiny was to bring the group together to bring Bavmorda down, not necessarily to do it herself, because she is literally a year old.
Well, yeah, right,
but she could talk to the pixies.
But in most cases, like the prophecy, like in the Odyssey, the prophecy was that what's his bucket would eventually kill the king. And yeah, he did, but not when he was a baby. He traveled for 40 years first and came home as an adult and killed the king. Yay.
I like the fact that he mentioned the Odyssey by name, but then couldn't come up with Odysseus. What's his bucket?
I'm sorry.
I
had a moment.
But I wanted to say, essentially, the baby in this movie is, and this is kind of cold, but she's nothing but the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's the glowing briefcase. She's the One Ring. Yeah.
What I don't get is why Bavmorda had to do a ritual to get rid of the baby. It's the baby. Drop it down a staircase.
It was the baby's spirit.
Right.
If you have all the pregnant women in your prison, I mean, why does it matter?
She seemed to feel that the baby specifically needed to be banished from this dimension entirely for her to feel secure.
Right.
So,
because the baby had the ability to make other people do things, and you don't want it as a free-floating spirit doing that.
You mentioned the wagon chase scene. Which I really is, I'm going to tell you guys, it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Not only is it a really fast-paced action sequence, but I have modeled so many ideas from that for running similar sequences in games. So it's definitely a visual I've always come back to. I really enjoyed the pace of it, the way it feels, the way it sounds, the way it looks. Sometimes, though, this is a sound of an oar hitting a person. You hear that again? I'm telling you. I'm just saying. I think I'm going to use that as a sneeze in the future.
Was that a Star Trek blaster and then ran through three filters?
I don't own a Star Trek
blaster. I thought it sounded like someone stepping through a cardboard box, personally.
Here's one of my favorite sequences after that.
Found some blackroot. He loves it.
Blackroot? I am the father of two children, and you never, ever give a baby blackroot.
Blackroot.
Well, my mother raised us on blackroot.
Explains so much.
Chair on your chest. Doesn't it, Dick?
Her name is not Stick. She's Elora Dannon, the future Empress of Tyr's Leap. And the last thing she's going to want is a hairy chest.
I love that one.
That was awesome.
That's such good
writing.
It
also goes back to Willow being a good father.
Right?
True. True.
Now, okay, if we're going to talk about Willow being a good father, we have to talk about Bavmorda being a horrible mother. Because all it takes is one non-consensual kiss and a guy repeating the words, I love you, I love you, I love you, for her to completely turn.
I have the words. I have the actual words.
Yes, play it. Oh, no, that's Alicia.
Yeah, that's a clip we need.
Here we go.
Wakefulness, hateful sleep. It deprives me of your beauty. The beauty of your eyes.
One move, jackass, and you really will be a woman.
I didn't get the rest, but you get the picture.
Yeah.
Because it went on forever. Oh, it was a long ass scene.
Pretty words and just stop saying that. I love you. Don't love say you. That. I love you. You're a liar. I love you. Oh, maybe you do.
Right. And then later, the moonlight is my eyes.
Okay.
But now it means nothing.
So
the power went away.
I did read something.
Wow.
That dynamic drove me crazy.
It went away. I dwell in darkness without you, and it went away.
As a character, irritated me.
She kicks him in the balls and runs back to Skeletor. And then in the next scene, she just stands there and watches while he kills all of her people. And she's just watching him. And watching him kill, watching him kill, watching him kill. And then all of a sudden she's like, you know what? I'm going to kill my people too.
I don't get it. She has no motivation at all to change sides, or at least not to convince him to try to change sides or something.
Yeah, if anything, she should say, hey, if you love me, come back to my place. You can be a prince alongside me with the queen. Yay.
Here's what Van Morta had to say.
Witless fools, do I have to do everything for you?
Oh, sorry, that was really Skeletor. I was confused.
I was going to say.
sounded just like her.
Say, if you're wondering what Van Morta had to say about it, it's first. Now, there was an interesting little bit of exposition there. I've consulted the stars, and your daughter will betray you. I trust her more than I trust you.
Dig that. I dig that.
And then, a little bit later, where's my daughter? She's betrayed you. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, her okay looked pretty mean, though. But everything she did looked pretty mean, so that's fine.
And then daughter shows up and goes, Mother, no! And Bav Morta's best line in the movie, other than pigs, was, I must despise you now.
I didn't like that line. You now. I did not like that line.
It sounded like she was reading a stage direction or something, right?
Exactly! And that is why that line was terrible!
See, I love that line, because it's like, you know, I love you because you're my daughter, but since you betrayed me, I must despise you now. I have no choice.
Right.
I don't have to sit here and go, but you're my daughter, and agonize over the decision. Nope, I must despise you now.
There's an underlying level of psychoticness underneath all of that passion she has for her existence and what she's doing in the world.
Pigs!
I will say, Bav Morta in that last scene, the way they did the makeup on her, she looks more evil in that entire scene than she does in the entire movie.
Which is saying something.
Oh, and since you brought up that scene, we cannot go without discussing the old lady boxing match, because that was awesome.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
And I captured a couple of really good sets. I'll get to them. I caught at least one or two.
The reason she looked so worse at that end, at that last scene, is because she had actually expended a lot of magic at that point, and it was taking its toll on her body.
That's really insightful.
And I'm going to bring that up here in a second when he's done with the clip. I've got more to say about that.
I had a couple of clips from the Galadorn scene. I could skip those if you guys want. The castle, the fight of the castle, the first castle.
For Tyrus Lane?
Tyrus Lane, great. Yeah, thank you.
I mean, you absolutely have to go back and rewatch it. to see all that, but we can skip by that.
Why did I listen to you, Peck? Everything will be all right once we get to Tyrus Lane.
I love the whining.
The only army around here is the one that's about to ride across this valley and wipe us out.
A little almost angry acting from Val Kilmer. I thought that was good.
And that's when he decides to home alone the castle.
Tyrus Lane is also a part that irritated me, though, because how many of those things are they actually capable of doing?
I have this labeled as troll. Oh, yeah, the troll sound effects. That was another one. I was like, what are we trying to...
Yeah, it was weird.
But everything about the troll was a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Wait, was that a Wilhelm scream?
Sorry.
Use the wand so it melts the troll into a creepy thing of brains and arms. Then he kicks it into the water and it turns into a giant two-headed dragon. What?
The other two Wilhelm screams I picked up were from that castle fight scene, and they were 3 minutes apart from each other.
So that was probably one of them.
Yeah.
It could easily have been.
This is what gets my blood pumping, though.
Yeah,
everybody's grabbing their mic, their headphones, like, can I hear it?
Could you guys
hear it?
Yeah,
that theme was incredible. Yeah.
I love the action music.
The score was great.
James Horner.
The score was probably the best part of the movie.
And I'll be completely honest with you. James Horner is a very special composer in my library, and this is my favorite album of his, hands down.
I can see that.
And the weird thing about that is with him that, and I won't stay on this for long. The weird thing is about with him is that this album is actually hard to get now. But he didn't really do a lot that I would say off the top of my head. Yeah, that's a soundtrack I got to get. When I thought about composers who are real thematic and strong and stuff like John Williams or Danny Elfman or, you know, even David Arnold, who obviously studied John Williams to death or something. But there's a lot of these great composers that have a lot of these strong themes and stuff. James Horner isn't that guy. But then one day while I was talking about this with somebody, I was like, because I collect scores. And when I say collect, this is back before the digital age when now collecting is kind of a pointless thing. I don't actually collect much anymore. I can just listen to it on, you know, whatever surface. But I would collect scores. I went to my collection and went, see those are my favorites. And I counted them up and realized I had more Horner than anything else by half. It's like, that really says a lot to me right there. He also did Titanic, you know, which was a huge hit.
And I did notice there was a score point, and I think it was attached to one of the songs connected to Willow interacting with his family or whatever. There were so many notes in common with that and Princess Leia's theme that it kept driving me nuts because I kept playing in the back of my head the Leia theme.
And there was a lot of...
Because there were some cross connections.
There felt like there was a lot of homage in this to other stuff because I felt like he wasn't like copying and using other stuff so much as you'd hear things that were reminiscent of things you knew.
Reminiscence, yeah. And trying to get that same energy level, but definitely not trying to copy paste.
I can actually picture Lucas going, okay, I want something like Leia's theme. Okay.
Yeah, that's possible.
This is like Leia's theme. Okay, back to Evil Witches.
I have, I only have a couple clips left, actually. Chant. Talk about the magic. Yeah, that's what all of it sounded like, stuff like that. Interesting kind of nonsense words, kind of, because I don't think there was anything familiar sounding in any of that. But
after all the Star Wars stuff that Lucas did a language mock-up to do that?
It's possible, but there wasn't enough of it to really give you anything, I think. Most of it was just repeated.
I guess I'm curious. I wish I'd looked that up. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. they did language mock-ups in Star Wars for languages that only had three words on screen.
My only comment about the actual witch fight is which is almost as much fun to listen to as it was to watch.
Okay, so
the wand whipping around and everything.
We're back to the witches. First off, damn, that was a long ritual.
Well,
prepare
as
the
they
ritual.
Should be, right?
It's sunset. Prepare the ritual. By daylight the next day, they're still going through the ritual. So, hey, yeah, talked about Rich using a lot of power. She's been going at this for 12, 15, 16 hours at least. Ritual, ritual, ritual. And then it's throwback to the evil queen in Snow White, who, in an effort to kill the pretty baby that's going to destroy her, she uses so much evil magic that it destroys her in the process. Bav Mortis starts young and kind of youngish and very Joan Collins, Crawford, beautiful woman. And by the end of it, her eyes are sunken and her teeth are exposed. And she's become a monster from all of this evil that she's concentrating.
And that's not Shadows of Palpatine or anything, right?
Believe it or not, I hadn't actually seen Snow White, so I didn't realize that's where that trope first came from. But yeah, no, that's where I noticed it was her usage of the power, because I noticed it was as she was really expending it in this moment that she started getting more of that look on her face, more of that evil look on her face. And it was exactly the way Palpatine does.
Interesting. I like that. Again, kind of a Lucasism, I guess. So that's not... That part doesn't feel terribly original, but I liked the execution of it.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
So, Willow, I mean, 1988, big part of my childhood, obviously, before Vanessa's time. And Rich was a little older. So, I mean, we have some kind of different perspective there. And I think that's kind of interesting. It hit us at different times in our lives.
Rich was older. I was a kid. Vanessa was a baby.
I was like 18 or 19. I think it was 19 when I would have hit the video store.
I would have been in junior high. So
the baby in the movie was probably older than me when it came out.
I don't think
when
Craig
started the old VCR so we could watch a movie.
we had pay channels.
I had Willow on Betamax.
We just said, oh my God.
What is this Betamax?
That's funny. It's proof that Sony can screw things up.
Do we really need more of that?
It's circumstantial. Definitely.
No offense, Sony. Feel free to sponsor us.
Not going to happen.
I don't see it happening.
Start wrapping it up here.
Okay.
Thumbs up, thumbs down. Who wants to start?
I get all my points.
I have to say,
yep.
It was highly inspiring. Very enjoyable, and I recommend it to everyone.
Thank you.
Oh yeah,
thumbs up, thumbs down.
That. Sorry, so I've got mine.
Go ahead,
my thumbs up. My thumbs up. What I really enjoyed overall was that it had the adventure and humor in it with a lot of the characters, and the most important part there was it continued to do that throughout the film without cutting the pacing. I didn't feel there was a lull. I didn't feel there was an inserted scene that made me go, why am I here? I need to go take a nap. So I enjoyed the pacing. I love the fact that we were able to do the action adventure comedy thing without having to break the pacing. My thumbs down, though, it came back to that whole, the character swapping alliance between that one captain and Mad Mardigan, and actually everything was around Mad Mardigan, and then Sorsha and her swapping of alliances, and a lot of the swaps drove me crazy, and I couldn't follow them.
I did read somewhere that there was a thing with Sorsha. I was going to mention earlier, there was a thing with Sorsha that kind of hit the cutting room floor, where there was some relationship with her father, who was basically cut out of the movie as a character. He's actually the old man in the scene at the end when they're sending Willow on his way. So there's no explanation for him, so he doesn't matter in that scene. There's no, but he's the actual character in the movie, and they apparently had a loving relationship, but her mother had really brainwashed her and kind of changed her, and that was supposed to be, I think, set up as an establishing
her
point.
Breaking away from that.
Right, realizing what her mother really represented when she got out there and dealt with all this, because originally she's just going and looking for the baby that's going to destroy her mom. You know, she presumably always had good, you know,
to be fair, she was slightly hesitant about to begin with, although her advisor warned her that she would turn against her.
But without that, but I mean, you know.
Without that, my thumbs down stance with absolutely. How the movie came out.
Vanessa?
Between both of those.
I actually agree with pretty much everything that Richard said. The pacing was good. The movie was well done. It had a story to tell, and it was able to tell it without detracting. The only real detractors were the swapping of alliance. My big one was Sorsha. I didn't really get as much of an attraction from Mad Mardigan and Eric's, but Sorsha's swap did not seem to make sense or fit anywhere, aside for it was foretold by the seer of Mad Morda.
Well, that makes sense. Jay?
Okay, so thumbs up. Music was amazing. The music made that movie.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Thumbs up also. Definitely. Billy Barty. Yay. Just... His mere existence, thumbs up. You got him in the movie, and it was amazing.
That's going to be my next caster, by the way, I do for a roleplay game.
You're going to do a nice. Billy Barty impersonation?
Nice.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do the whole thing with the eyebrows and the making up magic as I go along.
Okay.
And then some of my negatives was completely unnecessary plot bits. The party traveling with Willow, unnecessary, completely. The magic acorns, almost completely pointless.
Yeah.
Right.
Almost completely pointless. Right, because by the pointless. Time
they came it's into like, play.
They turned a plank of wood into stone on a bridge when he dropped one. He didn't even throw it. So it's like, oh, they're real. And then he throws it at the witch and she just goes, oh, never mind.
Right, and he threatened to use sorcery? One.
And then
passed out and didn't do it
again. The Sorsha thing is a big deal. Here's what I've got in my notes, word for word, on the Sorsha deal. Okay, non-consensual kiss and pretty words from a pretty man start to thaw the evil daughter who's just been looking for love from her evil mom her whole life. If she won't love me, I'll let abs fill the void.
I'll kill more abs.
Beautifully done. Kid?
Do his Habs have their own Twitter feed? I mean, they should.
Not anymore.
I don't think he has the Habs anymore.
Well, right, he has them,
but the Twitter feeds never just die.
Under a nice layer of more Val Kilmer.
Be
more
nice Val to Kilmer. Mr. Kilmer. Oh, by the way, one comment on that, because I was reading about this somewhere, and I actually dove down this right as we were getting started. The Acorns. The continuity issue with the Acorns, because he used three of them in the movie and was out at that point. But he was given four at the beginning. And apparently that scene that Kid was talking about with the boat, he dropped an acorn.
He dropped an acorn.
In the boat, which the boat sank because it turned to stone. And there is actually a scene on the shore after they get across from Rescue and Resolve from the island where Willow's hair is wet. And that's why, because when they originally shot it, he had been dunked underwater in that sequence.
And nothing that actually made it in the movie.
Oh, that was another thing that annoyed me, is why did he leave Alora Dannon on the beach when he went to the island with the witch? He should have taken her with him. But I guess if they were going to fight a fish and sink the boat, that's why they left the baby behind. We just missed that part.
You always got to plan for those things.
Anyway, thumbs up music, thumbs up Billy Barty, thumbs down to character switches and completely unnecessary plot points that could have made the movie 98 minutes and easy.
Good call.
And loved it overall.
Kid?
All right. Well, now it's hard for me to actually put anything out there that hasn't been said. Honestly, so thumbs up, I just got to say the characters. The characters in the movie are my big takeaway. I loved the characters. They were so well played. They were so well written, which is something that I wish I saw in more movies.
Yes.
So well done. And I was very, very happy. And that is what makes or breaks any story for me, right? Not just movies, is the characters. And in this movie, the characters were fantastic. I liked them all. I loved to hate the bad people. I loved to love the good people. It was so well done. My biggest thumbs down in the movie was the climax. I was very unsatisfied because in the end, after everything they've done, everything they've learned and grown, the bad guy defeats herself.
In a way.
And she does it by being clumsy and distracted.
Yeah, she's fooled.
And if she had simply been a more focused and less, I realize she'd been casting a ritual for 15 hours. We covered that. But if she had simply not let herself go at that point in the movie, she would have won. The heroes were out of anything they could do to stop it. She would have won. Prophecy be damned, it's over. She defeated herself, and I was very unsatisfied with that.
And actually, that goes back to my issue with the prophecy in the beginning, because if there hadn't been a prophecy, this is going to be some Matrix stuff. Would you still have knocked over the vase if I hadn't said anything? If there hadn't been a prophecy, she wouldn't have rounded up the babies. That baby wouldn't have been special. That baby wouldn't have been put on a raft and sent to Willow. Willow wouldn't have taken it to the witch on the island. That the one witch that can apparently defeat Bavorta would have stayed an animal on an island forever.
Yeah.
And that baby would have grown up in some poor village to some poor villager and never become anything of anything, except for the fact that Bavorta got so freaked out by it that she put the elements in for her own destruction. And then, Kid said, destructed herself.
It is literally the self-fulfilling prophecy trope.
Nice.
Self-fulfilling prophecy is self-fulfilling.
Well done, guys.
Yes.
Good stuff. You haven't swayed my opinion any. Five stars. No. 5 stars. How do we rate it?
I'm at 4.
3.
What?
4.
What's 4 for? What'd you mark down for?
In general, I it wasn't one that I'm going to say absolutely have to watch, blew me away,
made
the earth move, but I definitely would recommend it. I mean, you should watch it. If you have not seen it, you should watch it, but I'm not going to make it.
Which was why I felt made it a good pick for our premiere episode. Vanessa, 4, you say?
Yeah, 4 for me. It was a well-done story. It was extremely well done. Those detractors just don't take away from that 5-star material.
I disagree. Jay?
3 stars. 3 stars. Easy. Aww. Easy 3 stars. I'm not going to recommend this. You're kind of a bastard. You know that. if you haven't seen it, okay. If it comes on and you're watching it, or if somebody says, hey, let's watch Willow, it's one of my favorite movies, don't tell them no. Watch it with them. Sure. It's fine.
We'll watch it.
You know, it wasn't a waste of time, but... oh, there was
oh, says so much.
there was so much that could have been cut that wasn't. There was so much that was completely unnecessary. And like Jason, I really did not like the ending at all. The good guys were worthless in the end. When all comes to it, the bad lady defeated herself, and the bad lady's evil daughter changed her dress and is now going to raise the future empress with Shiny Pants McThief.
Yep. Who in an earlier draft actually also came from royalty, by the way. They cut that out because, you know, that was dumb.
Oh, holy crap. That they lone starred him?
Yep.
Yeah.
He was a friend? Yeah.
Mr. Kidd?
I have to give it a solid 4. And I liked it. I enjoyed it. It is not a movie I would have wanted to miss out on. But let's be honest, this is not the Fellowship of the Ring. This is not a movie that you cannot miss. And I reserve 5-star ratings for movies about which I cannot find any reason to give it less.
So you just said your standard.
I must watch repeatedly.
You just set your standard right there.
Yes.
Okay.
If I ever give a movie a 5-star rating, it's because I can't come up with a legitimate bad thing to say about it.
Rich, I don't think we need your calculator for this one.
No, it's definitely 4. It's straight up 4.0, right on.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. I want to make sure and let everybody know that next week's movie, what are we doing next week? We've talked about it. What are
we doing? Did we ever nail it down?
Constantine.
Constantine.
Oh, Constantine. Yeah.
Keanu.
Shia
LaBeouf. Actual cannibal. Yeah. So that'll be fun.
I look forward to that.
Make sure to join us next week. Thank you for joining us for Exposition Street, a Prismatic Film Cast. I think that's the way I said it. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, guys. Appreciate you. Appreciate it. You guys have a good day.
Bye.
And see.
There we go.